Last week we talked about how King Cyrus of Persia was moved by God to send the Israelites back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And then there were a couple kings after King Cyrus, and then we had King Xerxes. So we're going to kind of put him up here just for a minute. So we went this way up to King Xerxes, and then we've got a couple other kings that we talked about last week that were involved in last week's story, King Darius and Artaxerxes. Now, the story of Esther, which we're talking about today, it takes place right in the middle of what we were talking about all last week. It takes place during the reign of King Xerxes. And there were, sorry, I got moved here. I was thinking about a slide. Ryan, that last slide, can you take out the knot? Thank you, sir. And my brain went all the way to the end of the sermon, so I had a word that wasn't supposed to be there, and I didn't fix it between these services. So the story of Esther takes place right in the middle of all that we talked about last week, and it happens during the reign of King Xerxes. So during Cyrus, so a few kings before Xerxes, about 50,000 Israelites were sent back to Jerusalem to repair the temple. So we have a number of Israelites that leave here, but then we still have Israelites that are in Persia in all sorts of various places in Persia, spread around, scattered throughout. And so this story is about the Israelites who are still in the Persian areas and not in Jerusalem. They didn't. There was only a small group that returned in that first trip. So some interesting facts about the book of Esther as we're getting started. In the book of Esther, the word God is not mentioned at all. In fact, if you do a search for the word Lord or God, not anywhere in the book of Esther, anywhere. And there's only two books in the Old Testament that don't mention God. It's the book of Esther and the book of Song of Solomon or Song of Songs. And so that's kind of an interesting thing for a book that's in the Bible. It doesn't even mention God by name. Another thing about Esther that's kind of interesting is that in the New Testament quotes a lot of Old Testament books, but not Esther. Esther is never quoted in the New Testament. So just some interesting things. Esther's a, kind of a standalone little book. It's a little story nestled right in here. So we've got a story that starts here with King Xerxes, and he has a huge banquet, just a huge party. This guy, we're just going to learn, this guy just, he loves his parties. And so many open doors there to talk about some of our current or recent leaders. So he has this party, and it's a party that lasts for 6 months. And the purpose of this party is to show off all of his wealth and his splendor and the glory of his majesty. And the people that are attending this particular 6-month party were the nobles and the officials and the military leaders. So it's kind of all of his leaders are here, and he wants to show them how awesome he is. And so after this 6-month display of his earthly awesomeness, he threw another party, and this party lasted for 7 days, where everyone was invited to see how awesome the king was. And so the garden where the banquet took place, it was decorated extravagantly. You can read about that. The wine was served in goblets of gold, where each one different from the other. So unique goblets of gold, every one of them unique. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. So it's a 7-day party where the liquor is on the king. And it was abundant. And I'm just, at seven, can you just kind of picture this with me? 7 days, everybody's drinking. I just kind of have this, you know, I don't know, Daytona Beach, spring break, you know, Mardi Gras, you know, or whatever. You know, it just would have been a mess. And so we've got 7 straight days of drinking. On the 7th day, we're told that King Xerxes sends for his queen. So what do you think he's wanting all of these drunken people to know about his wife? Do you think maybe he wants her to come out and wow everyone with her intellect? Maybe deliver a lecture on the pros and cons of nuclear energy for Persia? Maybe he wanted to see her great personality and how sweet she was. Or how caring or nurturing or supportive of a wife she was as the king's wife. It was none of these reasons. He sent for her because of one reason, and we're told in Scripture, she was lovely to look at. So he had shown off all of his possessions And now he's just showing off another possession. He's showing off his trophy wife, just an object to him. We're told that when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Okay, so let me get this right. You want me to come and parade myself before a crazed mob of men after 7 straight days of Miller time? No, I don't think so. It's not going to happen. So she turns him down, and then we read the second half of that verse that then the king became furious. He burned with anger. I mean, everyone was there. I mean, you can imagine. You know, open bar, it's on the king. Anyone who wants to come is going to, you know, this place is packed with people from the kingdom there. Just tons of people from Persia. And this happens in front of everybody. So this makes him look weak. And so the king meets with his lawyers and his nobles to determine what must be done with Queen Vashti. I mean, this is a national emergency. And these are the king's lawyers. I mean, this isn't just, you know, little advice from friends. This is the Supreme Court that he's bringing in on this matter that his wife wasn't listening to him. You know, isn't there some rule somewhere that says that you have to do what the king says? I'm the king, for crying out loud. What can we do about this? And so one of his nobles speaks up and he says, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect in this court. We can't have this happen. The word gets out that she's disobedient. Then look at all of our wives are already starting after they heard about this. So they decide that what needs to happen is the king needs to write a decree that cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter into the presence of the king. Which isn't that what she wanted in the first place? You know, come here. No. Okay, then never come here. Okay. That works. You know, this guy who... Anyway, so the search for a new queen begins. I guess being queen isn't all that that you'd expect it to be, especially in this culture. So then the king's personal attendants, they proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem of the citadel of Susa. Now, his provinces, there was a lot of real estate at this point that was covered by Persia. And meant to check on that too. But if I remember right in the reading, there's 127 provinces. I mean, we're talking a lot of women, a lot of representation here it's just huge looking at this. So they want all of these in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem of the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This verse just cracks me up every time. This advice appealed to the king. Duh! Of course it did! I think it's funny that the writer here has to let us know. This advice appealed to the king. Let me see. Lots of young, beautiful women made even more beautiful and brought before me. Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah. And so he followed this advice. So this was Miss Persia pageant. But the prize wasn't for just a Miss Persia sash and a little fake tiara. It was for a royal crown, a crown that had it was a big deal. So you know these fine young men, women were looking their finest. So this is the criteria for the queen. Hottie. That's it. That was the criteria. I mean, can you believe? Can you believe that once there was a time when men were this superficial? I mean, a culture that elevated physical beauty and sexuality to such a level of importance. I know it's hard to imagine such a shallow culture. But I guess there was a time. I believe the Bible. I guess there was a time in history where such things went on. I mean, that's just, anyways, on a different topic. Did you know that this weekend down in Nashville, for 2 days, Sports Illustrated, they put on this huge celebration to launch their Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition 2015. And that just happened yesterday and Friday down in Nashville. And in fact, tonight, Sports Illustrated connected up with the Travel Channel. And tonight, starting tonight and through the rest of the week, they're having, inspired by this, a beach week. And they're going to be going to different beaches, I guess. But 1 hour a night is going to be dedicated to the making of the swimsuit edition. So some of the guys out there are thinking to themselves, I might have to check the TV schedule on that. You know, just to see what happened behind the scenes. You know, I'm always curious how they make that. So anyway, back on our topic today. Where was I at? Oh yeah, we're so far removed from a culture that would exist this shallow as the Persian did under the rule of King Xerxes, where beauty was the only qualification for a queen. So just so shallow. So the search begins. And Esther, one of these beautiful young virgins selected to compete for the position of the queen of Persia, she is an Israelite. She is a Jew. And so another thing that we know about Esther is that she was an orphan. And she was adopted by her cousin. His name is Mordecai. We'll be hearing a little bit about him through the story also. And he took care of her as though he were her very own father. So just a very, very neat relationship that was there between the two of them. So Esther appeared before Haggai and won his favor. And so she moved on to round two. You know, the swimsuit competition worked all right. The evening gown was a little shaky. But then, you know, when she said during the interview process that she wanted world peace, nailed it. So she moves on to round two. And round two was actually being able to appear before the king. Now, ladies, I need to ask you something. How many of you have ever spent more than an hour preparing for a date? Okay, first service lied to me. I only had, okay, really? Okay, yeah, Logan is holding Holly's hand up, so. So, really, prom, you know, you don't count that, you didn't spend, okay, so. You know, there's some ladies who spend more time getting ready for a date than actually going on the date. It's longer getting ready than the whole time that was on the date, and actually, many of them had more fun getting ready for the date than they did on the date itself. So Esther didn't just prepare for an hour, a few hours, a few days, a few months. It was a year to prepare for this date, a year of beauty treatments before appearing before the king. And when she finally got her chance to appear before the king, he found her more attractive than any of the other women, and so she won the prize. She became the queen of Persia in Vashti's place. So then there's this little story about Mordecai that happens in here. One day Mordecai, and that was Esther's cousin who took her in as his daughter. So the father-cousin, the cousin-father relationship there. So Mordecai was sitting by the king's gate and he heard two men discussing an assassination plot on the king. And so since, of course, he had his connection with Esther, he told Esther and Esther told the king and their plan was thwarted and they were hung up on poles, which through the book of Esther, a number of people were executed in this way, and there's some translation issue here. So one way, they're either hung on poles where they're impaled. Another way to translate this is that they're hung on gallows, which means that they were hung. So, but either way, they're what? They're dead. Okay, so either way. So these guys, that's how they ended. So in the process, when Esther had reported to the king, she made sure that she gave Mordecai credit for finding out the information, and it was recorded in the king's record book. And this is an important little detail a little later in the story. So we've got King Xerxes, we've got Esther, and we've got Mordecai. Then we've got this other character that emerges, and his name is Haman. Haman rises to power, and he was honored by King Xerxes, and he was one of his officials. And I don't know if it was just, I mean, when you get to know Haman a little bit, you kind of understand that there's not really much to like about this guy. He is stuck on himself, arrogant, selfish, And so Mordecai didn't care much for him. For whatever reason it was, you could pick a number of different reasons. But he would not pay honor to him by kneeling down before him like everyone else did, because that's what you would do when the officials came by. So other officials spoke to Mordecai, and they reprimanded him about this. They spoke to him many times, and he still would not give honor when Haman walked by. And Haman was very insulted by this. He did not like this. And so a little bit of a narcissist. So he did some digging, and he found out that Mordecai was a Jew. And so what he did was, instead of just punishing Mordecai, he figured, man, I'm going to go after all of his people and really, really stick it to him. So he went after the whole captive nation of the Jews. So Haman goes to the king, and he tells him that there's this group of people that just don't fit in. They're not with the culture. They don't have the same customs as the Persians. And in fact, they don't obey the king's laws. And it wouldn't be a good idea to keep this group of people around. It'd be a really good idea to get rid of them. He says, if it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. And I will put 10,000 talents of silver, which is just a bunch of money, into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, and the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do it the people as you please. This guy, this king, I mean, it's just that he's in this position of authority, and you just see, you know, he's just a party guy, just 6 months of party, and then 7 days of party, and just party, party, party. And then in this case, Haman's coming to him, he's like, hey, there's a group of people, and I want to wipe them all out. And he's like, whatever. Here's my ring. You know, the signet ring was a big deal. This was the signature of the king. And he's like, here's my ring. Just bring it back when you're done. You know, it's just do whatever you want with these people. It just, the irresponsibility of his leadership is amazing. He's in a position of power, and it's just, it's dealt with in such a negligent way. It's genocide. Is what Haman is wanting to do here. So word gets out about this genocide. And when Mordecai hears about what's to happen, we're told that he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews. So we understand the Jews were spread out all over. With fasting and weeping and wailing, they lay in sackcloth and ashes. So this is a protest as well as a way of humbling himself and praying. It's a custom there, but it was also a very public thing that Mordecai was doing, walking around like this to stir up this awareness that this is what's going to happen. It's a genocide. And so Esther found out what was troubling Mordecai through one of the servants that the king had appointed to her. And Mordecai then sends a message to her and says, hey, you need to go to the king because you're queen. You need to go to the king and you need to beg for mercy on our people. But she sent word back to Mordecai saying, I can't do that. If I go before the king without being summoned, I could be killed. I could be that the punishment for that is death. The only way to escape that is if the king would choose to extend the gold scepter, which was a sign that they could come before him unsummoned. And spare the life of the person who has asked to appear before him. So when the servant told Mordecai what Esther's response was, he sent the servant back to Esther and said, oh, okay, well, no big deal. We'll just figure out another way. No. He's like, no, you don't understand the brevity of this. And you're involved in this too. Listen to what he says. It says, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all Jews will escape. For you, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. So there's a lot of faith there. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows, but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this. And that right there, that second half of that verse, that is just the spotlight. That is the thesis statement of the book of Esther. In my understanding, a lot of other people's understandings, the way they look at it, just that, if we can go back to that, just that final little thing there. And who knows, but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Mordecai speaks into Esther's life. He says, you know, this is what's going to happen. This is the risk, but it's worth taking it because there's really not much of a choice. Here's what you got to do. And I want to speak into your life about this. I want to share this with you. I want to encourage you through this. I want to challenge you in this. Maybe God puts you there for something bigger than being queen. This is Persia. And he's saying, maybe you have something that your purpose is bigger than simply being the queen. So Esther replies. She says, then pray for me. She says, go gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And my maids and I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king. Even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. So Esther goes before the king, and he extends the gold scepter. Whew. You know, that meant that she was going to live. She was going to live through this. She wasn't going to die. And he asked her, he said, what is it, Queen Esther? What would you like for me to do for you? And she said, well, I've got this party. She knows how to get to him, you know. I've got this banquet that I've prepared. I've got this little party that I've got. And I would like for you to come. And I would like to invite Haman also. So that the two of you guys come to this little private party of mine. And we'll just eat and we'll have a great time. So the king and Haman, they go to this banquet. And at the banquet, the king says, okay, what would you like for me to do for you? You know, I'm here. What is it you'd like? And Esther says, I want you to come back for another party. I want you to come back for another banquet. And at that time, I'll tell you what I would like, what my request is. So they agreed to return to the second banquet. Now, Haman is on cloud 9 through all this. I mean, just and when you get to see his personality, you know, it's all just catering to him, you know, his importance. And it's boosting his ego. And he was invited to this special dinner with the queen and the king and him. He was there. You can't get in a more top-notch crowd than that. And so he's just on cloud 9. And then he passes by the king's gate, and who does he see? Mordecai. And Mordecai, of course, doesn't bow to him. And this just ruins his day. And he goes from cloud 9 to cloud negative 9. It ruins his day. He's all been out of shape. And even though he's got the king's permission to go forward with this genocide, it's going to take some time to make that happen. That's not quick enough for him. He's got to get rid of this Mordecai the Jew. He's got to go. And so he went home and he talked it over with his wife and his friends, and they suggest that he builds a pole or a gallows in front of his house 75 feet high so that Mordecai can be killed on it. If it's impaling or if it's hanging, whatever the translation means. And so Haman liked that idea. So he builds a 75 foot high gallows or pole. So later that night, the king couldn't sleep. So, okay, the story tells so well. The king couldn't sleep, and so he asked that the book of records to be read to him. And it just so happened that the very story, and even though God's name is never mentioned in this book, boy, you can just see his hand. You can just see how he's moving things and setting things up. You know, Queen Esther, you're queen for a reason. You're going to save the Jews. I just spoiled the end of the story. So you guys knew that. So, but and then right here, and you know, he goes to read or have the book of records read to him, and it just so happens that the book opens up, and the story that's read to him is the story about how Mordecai saved the king from the assassination attempt. And the king asked, has anything been done to honor this man? He saved my life. We should throw a party. Now, so Haman was in the court. And so Haman was in the court, so the king summoned for him to come in. And I love this. I just got to read this straight from some scriptures. He says, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, of course it's me. You know, he thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, and I just kind of picture him just kind of building this and putting it together in his head as he just talks, you know. Maybe have him bring a royal robe that the king has worn. Yeah, a robe the king has worn and a horse that the king has ridden. Yeah, that's the ticket. Then one with a royal crest placed on his head. Then let the robes and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man, and the king delights to honor me, and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Oh, man. And Haman's day just keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And so the king says, go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just what you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew. Oh, who sits at the king's gate. And remember, he's sitting there in sackcloth and ashes, will not bow before him. And so now he's got to go and take the king's horse and the king's robe and take it to him, this guy that's just, oh my goodness, it's just awful for Haman. So he does this. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man who the king, or the man the king delights to honor. He's the lowest of the low. If he was at -9, he's at -900 now. And Haman is just depressed beyond depression. It's just, he's so upset over this. He goes home, he covers his head in grief, and he's all just whining and complaining, talking to his friends and his wife about what happened. And all while that's going on, ding dong, you know, no, it's not dominoes, it's his ride. And it's ride to go to the second banquet. And so he's got to get himself together. So he goes off to go to the second banquet. So at the second dinner, the second banquet, second party, the king asks Esther, what is it you want? And Queen Esther answered, if I found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Who is this man, or who is the man who has dared to do such a thing? Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this vile Haman. Oh, no. So the king is so upset by this. He leaves the room. He's out of there. He's just so mad that he leaves. And when the king is gone, Haman starts to beg. This is awful. It just gets worse and worse. It's almost done for him, but it's got one step more to get worse before it's over. So he begs for her life. So if you can just kind of picture this. Often in those times, people would eat lounged or reclining or whatever. So she's all lounged out, you know, spread out on this couch where she's been eating. And, you know, and so Haman now, he's over there and he's begging at her, you know. So if you can kind of get this in your head, you know, on the couch, he's right there. And the king walks in. Not good. He says, and when the king walks in, he says, will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house? So just not good. So the king finds out that there's a 75-foot gallows or pole in front of his own house, the pole that was meant for Mordecai. And so the king has Haman hung on the gallows or impaled on that pole right in front of his own house, the one that was meant for Mordecai. So Mordecai is then raised up into Haman's position with the king. So he takes his place. Esther is given Haman's estate. Hopefully they took the body down. Because that would just get nasty after a while. Mordecai and Esther are given permission to write a decree that allowed the Jews to defend themselves if they were attacked from Haman's decree of genocide. Haman's decree was sealed with the signet ring, which meant that it could not be repealed. It could not be revoked, changed, whatever. These guys, they had full permission from the king, according to the signet ring, to attack the Jews and kill them. And that was all right. So when Queen Esther and Mordecai got a chance to write a law, they said, okay, well, we're going to write a law saying that they can defend themselves. And not just defend themselves. This isn't just like a conceal and carry. You know, if they draw, you can shoot. Or if it's life-threatening. No, no, no. It's not just defending yourself against the person who attacked you. It's an annihilation. It's against, if they attack you, you can kill them, kill their family, their kids, their women, and then you plunder them. You take anything you want from their riches and their wealth. And you think that this would be enough to discourage them from following, you know, the freedom that they had through Haman's decree of genocide. But no, there were still some people who were stupid enough to attack the Jews, and the Jews defended themselves, and they overpowered them, and they annihilated them. And so then, extra little detail before the end of the story, Esther and Mordecai have the rest of Haman's sons killed, and then they lived happily ever after. Here we go. So let's talk for a moment, just real quick, about position. This whole book, that light just comes down to that one verse, for such a time as this. So this position that you've been brought into, and it's not just Esther. We've got a number of different positions that are shared in this story. We've got some bad examples of how to handle position and some good examples. So let's look at some bad examples first so we can end on the good side. So bad uses of position. First of all, we've got King Xerxes. And he's a great example of what it's like to occupy a position of power negligently. And you just look at him. He's like, yeah, you want to kill a bunch of people in my kingdom? Yeah, I don't care. So what? Whatever. Do whatever you want to do. Can we throw a party afterwards? You know? But it's just, you see this guy, it's so hard to take King Xerxes seriously in what we're shown in the book of Esther. He just doesn't seem to take his position of power with any kind of seriousness and any kind of responsibility. So as we look at that and we reflect on that in our own personal lives, I want you to think, what position are you in? Are you in a position of power somewhere? I guarantee everyone in this room is at some level. And it might be something as simple as just understanding this is on a work related type of side, where you have people that answer to you. You are just in a position of power over them. How do you handle that position of power? Is it with responsibility? Is it negligently? Or maybe it's one of the, or not one, maybe it's the men in the room here, the fathers, the husbands. Guys, we have been commissioned by God to be the man of the house, to lead your family, to lead your wife, to lead your kids spiritually, to be the spiritual leader. That is a position of God-given power. How are you handling that power? Are you being responsible with it? Or are you being negligent? If you're a parent here this morning, you are entrusted by God in a position of power over your children to train them, to lead them, to be an example for them. Are you occupying that position of power responsibly or negligently? Just something to think about as we reflect on King Xerxes. So what about Haman, the other negative character here in this story? Haman is an example of what it's like to occupy a position of influence selfishly. And Haman had a lot of influence, and we see a lot of selfish behavior here. And you might not realize it, but you are in a position of influence with so many people in your life. And you might not realize it, you might not think about it, but you really are. You've got friends, you've got coworkers, family members, neighbors, people that you're in a relationship with, that there's some influence there. How do you use your position of influence? Is it to get what you want? Is it for selfish motives? What can I get out of this arrangement? And I want you to be honest with yourself, because this is not easy to do. And I can't hear your thoughts, and even if I could, I wouldn't know which ones are true and which are false, but God knows your thoughts. And God knows which ones are true and false, and it's not going to help you any today to try and lie to yourself. And I say that because I think a lot of us are just so disgusted with Haman because we see a part of ourselves in him. We see a part of ourselves reflected in Haman. This selfishness that creeps up. And we know that it's wrong. We know to use a position of influence selfishly is wrong. But we still do it. And that's a bad use of position. So that's two bad uses of position. So what about good uses? Good uses of position. Let's look at Mordecai. Mordecai spoke into Esther's life. So let's write that down. Mordecai is an example of what it's like to speak into lives of people who look up to you. Mordecai invested into Esther. He took her in as she were his daughter. And he invested into that relationship. She was the queen, and yet she still looked up to Mordecai because they had history, they had a relationship. Who are you investing into? Who are you pouring into? Who are you speaking words of life to? Because that's so empowering. If this story were just about Esther and Xerxes and Haman, it wouldn't have been the story that it was. Mordecai was a very important piece. So think about some of these things, like based off of Mordecai's actions. When you're speaking life into someone, support them. Support them. I mean, there's so much power from someone that you look up to for them to say to you, "I believe in you." There's so much support in that, so much power in that. That goes such a long way. Someone that you're close to, someone that you respect, to hear them say, "I believe in you." Who needs to hear that from your mouth? Who needs to hear that from your heart? "I believe in you." Support, support. Challenge them. You know, in Mordecai's case with Esther, he's like, it is worth the risk. Are you willing to risk it? You know, are you close enough to speak into someone's life that intimately, to look at some of their life situations? And I'm not talking about speaking down to them in a condescending way or a way that tears them down, but to speak into their life in a way that helps them to see a bigger picture, that they're part of an upper story that God's involved in. You know, here's what you're doing. Here's what you could be doing. Why haven't you done it? What's it going to take? It's worth the risk. Are you willing to risk it? So challenge them. Another way you can speak life into someone is to encourage them. You're made for something bigger. That's not the statement to tell your wife if she asks how she looks in those jeans. No. So Mordecai, so you got it. Don't use it there. But everywhere else, listen, you're made for something bigger. You're made for something better. You're queen of Persia. But guess what? Let me encourage you. You're made for something bigger. You're made for something better. Who needs to hear that from you? Who needs to hear words like that? That level of encouragement to speak into someone's life. Someone that looks up to you for you to tell them, you're made for something bigger. You're made for something better. Encourage them. And then one last character, let's look at Esther's position. And I mean, this really is the culmination of it all. Esther, to look for the purpose in the position God has placed you in. So easy. It's so easy to let the position distract us from the purpose. The purpose should always be more important than the position. Always. Position doesn't mean anything if there's no purpose. The position is simply the vehicle. The purpose is the destination. The position is just the way to get to the purpose. Whatever position you're in, see the purpose in it. And let the position be the vehicle. Let that be the way that you get there. But the destination, the real point B, it's not the position. The real point B is the purpose. Why am I here? What can I do? There are a lot of good uses and bad uses of position. So let's be reminded of those today and make better use of our position.